Krishna's killing the demons is known to all the devotees, because you can't be a devotee without hearing about the Lord killing some of the other demons. If you are a devotee, you have definitely heard at least some pastimes of Krishna killing the demons. Even in general, in India, it is common knowledge. For example, Ram killing Ravan, it's something that every child knows. Similarly, Krishna killing Kamsa, etc. So these are very popular pastimes. And Srila Prabhupada explains that even in Krishna Leela, in Vrindavan, every day before lunch, Krishna would kill a couple of asuras. They were like appetizers for him. He would not probably get hungry till he had disposed of a few. So, 2-3 asuras every day. Imagine how many asuras he must have killed. But in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find mention of very few. Because Shukadeva Goswami selected only certain important asuras, noteworthy asuras, and then he described them. And he talked about how Krishna killed those demons. In the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami talks about the devotees Krishna killed in Vrindavan, then when he went to Mathura, and also in other places. So, little quiz. Talking about the demons who were not subdued but killed, how many were there in Vrindavan Leela? Who can list chronologically? How many were there, first of all, roughly? Can you see a rough figure? You still get an extra mantra, sir. Very close. It's 12. If you don't consider Kalia, because Kalia was not killed, he was only subdued. Of course, the forest fires were also considered demons, who had come in the form of forest fire, but we talk of actual killing, they have some tangible form. Well, first was?
Putana.
Then?
Shakatasara.
Third?
Vakasura.
And after this came the Damodar Leela. So, Nalukubar Manigri were delivered. So, it's not exactly a killing, and the other is the deliverance. And after that, you had who else? Who was next in the list?
Vakasur.
Vatsasur. Vakasur. Aghasur. And yeah, then Balaram also came in the picture. So he killed Dhenukasur, he killed Kalambasur. And many other pastimes happened before and in between and after that. Including Krishna's lifting of the Govardhan Hill and many such pastimes. And towards the later part of his Vrindavan Leela, which were the demons that Krishna killed? No, Vrindavan Leela. Vrindavan. Shankachur. Yes? Then who else? Arishtasur. Keshi. And who was the very last? That Shukadeva Goswami. He may not have actually been the last. He may have disposed a few on the way here and there also. And Shukadeva Goswami doesn't mention. That's also possible. But in the Srimad Bhagavatam, who is the last one? He killed in Vrindavan. Vyomasura. Keshi was the second last. So Krishna killed so many demons, and the noteworthy ones are mentioned by Shukadeva Goswami. Then Krishna entered Mathura. The and who was the first one whom he killed? Kamsa came at the end, later.
The elephant.
It was the forehead. Dobi, the washerman. The washerman. Then Kuvalya Pira, the mad elephant. And then? Janur, Shala, Toshala. And Balaram killed Mushtik. And after that?
Kamsa.
Kamsa, yes. And then in the Avanti Leela, because when Krishna was in Mathura, he also went for some time to Avanti to study under Sandipada Muni. And at the end of that period, he killed a demon. Who was that?
Shankarsur.
Yeah, Shankarsur came before the Vrindavan Leela. This is Panchajana.
Panchajana.
And that's how he got his Shankar, which became known as Panchajanya. And then after that came the Dwarka Leela. So who were some of the demons killed in Dwarka Leela? Murari. Because of which Krishna became?
Murari.
Then Narakasura or Bhaumasura. Before he killed Bhaumasura, he killed his general, Mura. And then after that?
Shishupala.
Who else?
Then Pandurak. Pandurak.
Pondrak. Yes. Pondrak. Then Shishupala, Shalva, Dantavakra, Viduratha. So these are the demons that Krishna killed in his Dwarka Leela. There is a corridor in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Dantavakra was the last. It is recorded. And after that, although it isn't mentioned by Shukadeva Goswami, but Jiva Goswami mentions it, that Krishna actually came back to Vrindavan. He spent some time. This is the first time he returned in his Prakat Leela, manifest pastimes, to Vrindavan after leaving. So he came for a while, associated with the devotees, and then returned. Even in his other expansions and incarnations, Krishna killed many demons. For example, as Narasimhadev, he killed Hiranyakashipu. As Varahadev, he killed Hiranyaksha. As Lord Ram, he killed Ravan, Kumbhakarna. And there were so many other demons. Can you mention demons killed by the Lord in other avatars? Ram I mentioned, Varaha. Yes, that is Narasimha. Then who else? Parashuram. Okay, Parashuram killed many, but demons in particular, famous big demons.
Killing Bali.
Bali, yes. Of course.
Not a devotee.
But as they say here, yes, hardcore demons.
Karabhushan,
yes, all of them. And what about Madhu? Yes.
Madhu Kaitav.
Demon Madhu and Kaitav.
Kaitav.
So Madhu and Kaitav are demons that were. Anyway, that's a long story, read in the Puranas. Because they had wounds that they could never be killed by anybody. And Brahma had given them the wound. He could only be killed by his own desire. They came out of Brahma's ears, actually. And they became so powerful that everybody was in great trouble. Finally, Brahma approached Vishnu and said, please help. And Vishnu said, all right, you got me. You have this habit of giving me wounds. And just see what has happened. So, Vishnu went to Madhu and sweet talked him. And they had a battle. And then he said, you are so powerful, actually. Then Madhu's ego was inflated. He said, okay, what boon do you want? He said, I want your death. So Krishna is called Madhusudan because he killed Madhu Leela, but not in his Krishna Leela as Lord Vishnu. What are the other names of Krishna in connection with killing of demons?
Madhusudan.
Madhusudan, I said.
Murari.
Murari, that he said. Keshav. Keshav has many meanings. One of the meanings is Keshav or Keshi. And who else? What are the names of Krishna? Kamsari. Kamsari is the name of Krishna. It comes in the Srimad Bhagavatam also. Kamsari, the enemy of Kamsa. So you can make up so many names, and they'll all be valid names of Krishna. Sanskrit is a very flexible language. You can combine words in such a way that you can unlimitedly make new words, and they'll all be legitimate words, so long as you follow the laws of grammar. And here, of course, you have to factually also indicate that Krishna did kill those demons. Like Kamsari indicates that Krishna is the killer of Kamsa. I think there was a disciple of Srila Prabhupada called Ravana, is it? From Iran? Yes, I'm not sure, but I think Ravana. So there are so many names. You can give any number of names to the Supreme Lord, depending on his pastime. What are his names after all? Krishna doesn't have a name of his own. Krishna's names are given by the devotees. So Krishna has so many names, and each devotee, according to his or her devotional ecstasy, gives a name to the Lord. So therefore, the killing of demons is something that is very frequently done by the Supreme Lord in his descent into this material world. And considering that he does it so often, and is such a prominent pastime, a prominent part of his pastimes on the earth or in the material world, it's important for us to know more about it, isn't it? There are many questions that arise in relation to Krishna's killing of the demons. What could be some of the questions in relation to Krishna killing the demons? What's the first and most logical question that comes to your mind?
Why
does he kill them? Correct? Why does Krishna kill the demons? What other questions arise in this connection?
Why can't he kill all of them at once?
Okay, that is part of the question, why does he kill? What else?
What happens to them after Krishna?
That's right. What happens to them after they are killed by Krishna? That's also an important point. Yes.
How come the demons are so fortunate to fight with Krishna?
Okay, how come the demons are so fortunate to fight with Krishna? Okay.
Why all the demons are from Indian subcontinent?
No, that's not true. Not that all the demons are from Indian subcontinent, from all over the universe. Of course, in Krishna Leela, these demons were sent to. We are talking about the Vrindavan Leela. And in our discussion today, tomorrow, day after, we'll especially focus on Krishna and Vrindavan, although we will make references here and there to other pastimes. But essentially, Krishna Leela, you know, they were all demons who were sent by Kamsa. Kamsa had a huge army of demonic assistants. And he would dispatch them on missions to kill Krishna. And naturally, instead of killing Krishna, they would end up being killed by Krishna. So yes, what would happen to them after they were killed by Krishna? Then another question arises. Do different types of demons attain different destinations after being killed by Krishna vis-a-vis the other avatars? Or do they all get the same destination? That means now I'm making a distinction between Krishna of Vrindavan and his avatars. So when the avatars kill the demons, what destination do they get? When Krishna kills the demons, what destination do they get? Then again, from the demon side point of view, which demon gets what destination when killed by Krishna in Vrindavan or Krishna in Dwarka, whatever? Do all the demons killed by Krishna get the same destination? So there are so many questions that come up. But first and foremost, let's talk about the basic question, why does Krishna kill demons? Sometimes this may seem like an act that is so violent and killing and blood. For example, if you look at Narasimha Dev's picture where he is tearing out the chest of Hiranyakashipu, and then he takes out the intestines and puts it around his own neck as a garland. If any other person were to do that, it would have been very costly. Correct? Imagine if a human being was to kill another human being like that and do the same thing, what would we say? In which mode is it of nature? Mode of ignorance. So when Lord Narasimhadev kills Hiranyakashipu, his head, body splattered with blood, he tears up his chest, puts the intestines around himself, is it a tamasic act?
No.
Is it an act in the mode of ignorance?
No.
No. Why not?
Transcendental.
Because he is a Supreme Lord, he is transcendental, he is above the modes of nature. So every act of Krishna is a transcendental act. Those acts or similar acts when performed by conditioned living entities will be classified differently and will have different reactions. But when Krishna kills the demons, then it's not like any other person killing the demons. So Krishna is not touched by the material effects of that, because he is always transcendentally situated. Not just beyond the mode of ignorance, Krishna is also beyond the mode of passion and beyond the mode of goodness. Say Krishna is performing the Rasa Leela. Now if an ordinary man were to go out and dance in the middle of the night with many ladies, that would be under which mode?
Passion.
Mode of passion. So is Krishna dancing with the gopis in the mode of passion? No. He's always beyond the mode of passion also. Then you may say, well, what about the mode of goodness? When Krishna and Balaram went to Avantipur to study under Sandipani Muni, they were following a life of strict discipline and studying whatever the teacher taught them, very quietly sitting, being well behaved. So which mode? So the activity is in the mode of goodness. But when Krishna does it,
it's beyond.
So whether Krishna is studying in Avanti under Sandipani Muni, whether he is doing the Rasa Leela, whether he is killing demons, acts which performed by others would have been classified under the modes of goodness, passion and ignorance, in the case of Krishna, it is always transcendental, because Krishna is always aloof. So Krishna is never touched by the three modes of ignorance. So therefore his killing of the demons also may appear to be something like an activity of the mode of ignorance done by others, but we have to be careful, no. So let's talk about why Krishna kills the demons. There are many reasons that we'll talk about. I'll specifically talk about six reasons. And we'll see how far we go today. If we have time, we'll do all six. Otherwise, we'll continue till tomorrow. Continue the discussion tomorrow. Shri Gauranathai ki jai, Shri Gopal ji ki jai, Shri Sitaram Lakshmana. Okay, so the first reason for Krishna killing the demons is that he is keeping his promise made in the Bhagavad Gita. And he makes three promises in the Bhagavad Gita. He actually makes so many promises, but in this connection, he makes three promises. Paritranaya sadhunam, vinashaya cha dushkritam, dharma samsthapanarthaya samprabhami sudevide. So the three promises that Krishna makes in this verse is that in every age I descend, from time to time I come here, and what do I do? Why do I come? To deliver or to protect the devotees. Number one. Paritranaya sadhana. Second, to destroy the miscreants. Vinashaya cha dushkritam. And third, to establish the principles of dharma or religion. Dharma sansthapana adhaya. Now, let's look at the killing of demons. Why does Krishna have to kill demons? Why does he promise that I will come down and kill the demons? Because the demons by nature always create a disturbance. they never let, they never live peacefully themselves, and they never let others live peacefully also. The demons are the ones who, by their own nature, try to create an imbalance or a disturbance. And according to certain very fine laws that the Supreme Lord has set in motion. And those laws work in perfect balance and harmony. So the whole creation of God is a masterly exhibition of harmony and superb craftsmanship. How Krishna has made everything so delicately balanced. Even in our body, look at your own body and see how it's functioning. From the macro level of Mahavishnu's level and even beyond, right down to the subatomic level, everything is so finely balanced. And you do a little change in that, it creates a disharmony. Nowadays we are all talking about global warming and climate change and so many other things are happening because man by his activities is disturbing nature. So this is a demoniac activity. To disturb the harmony of God's creation is a demoniac activity. In the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna speaks about the divine and the demoniac natures. While describing the demoniac nature, Krishna says, he talks about their guru, we don't have time to discuss all those verses. In one verse Krishna says, Etam Krishtamavashtabhya Nashtatmano Kapudhaya Prabhavan Yukra Karmanaha Kshayaya Jagato Mitaha. He says, Etam Krishtamavashtabhya, accepting such a vision of life. What kind of vision of life? There is no God. This world is only meant for enjoyment. Enjoyment and lust is the only foundation for everything in the world. I must enjoy life. Even if necessary, I have to subdue others, to kill others. And the tendency to accumulate more and more. So, someone who has this kind of vision of the world and an approach to life is called a demon. So, etam drishtim avashtabhya, so accepting such a philosophy of life, nashta atmanaha, they become lost to themselves. Alpa buddhayaha, they have very little intelligence. And what do they do? Prabhavanti ukra karmanaha, they perform horrible and painful acts, ukra karma. Kshayaya, jagato, ahitaha. Which are meant for the ultimate destruction of the world. So, ugra karma is something we see very often. But, and Prabhupada in the purport to that verse speaks about the atomic bombs as an example of ugra karma. It creates such a devastation, such a disturbance in the harmony that Krishna has made. So, also, we see that today there are natural calamities that come. And many of these natural calamities can be understood to be because of, at a gross level and a subtle level, human beings violating the harmony set in place by Krishna. We have huge digging with these giant, massive equipment that go deep into the earth. You can have underground railways going 5 stories down. Some kilometers underground. So imagine the kind of digging you have to do. You're shaking the earth to the core. So at the slightest balance of the earth is lost, it may generate tsunamis, it may generate anything. So we don't have data to understand how these horrible activities which are shaking the earth, digging, can alter the balance. And then sometimes, somewhere the reaction comes up by a tsunami or an earthquake or whatever it is. So these things are going on in nature. Hiranyaksha was doing the same thing. He was digging for gold. He was digging up the whole earth. So much so that the earth's orbit went out of balance and the earth fell into the Garbhodaka ocean. And then the Lord had to come as Varahadeva to lift the earth out, to rescue the earth and place her back in her orbit. So today also we are following in the footsteps of Hiranyaksha. Digging for oil, atom bombs, and going so far down to And it's not just some small digging with a pickaxe or something. These are huge, gigantic machines. And they look like demons themselves, actually. One time we were in Braj, going on parikrama, and we saw this huge agricultural machine, like a combined harvester, making a terrible noise with all sorts of pointed things like this. This looks straight out of Krishna book. Yes, all this horrible, sharp, pointed, huge things making a noise, and supposed to be cutting crops or so on. So all these things are examples of upikarma, some small, some bad. So the demons, by nature, they like to disturb. They take pleasure in disturbing the nature or the harmony of this world. So therefore, it is necessary for them to be killed. So sometimes Krishna lets material, the laws of material nature, do the needful. Sometimes he gets the demons themselves to fight each other and kill them. Sometimes he empowers the devotees to do the needful. And sometimes he himself comes to do the needful. And the killing of demons is not necessary only because if they disturb the natural order, but also because it is necessary to establish religious principles. And demons are the one who destroy religious principles as well. The demons are those who don't follow Dharma. And they don't allow others to follow Dharma also. So when the demons are present, then there is a decline in Dharma and a rise of Adharma. This is also stated by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. So when the demons are killed by Krishna, then automatically the Dharma is also upheld, because those who are destroying Dharma are now removed from the scene. So we can see that the killing of demons is connected to Dharma Sansthapanarthaya as well. And it's also connected to the Paritranaya Sadhuna portion of the verse, which means that Krishna kills demons to protect the devotees. Srila Prabhupada mentions at one place that Krishna, as Narasimhadeva, didn't come to kill Hiranyakashipu. Now you may be surprised. What did he come to do? What did he come to do?
Protect
Prahlad. So Krishna came as Lord Narasimhadeva not so much to kill Hiranyakashipu, but he came to save Prahlad. So that is Krishna's main purpose, to protect the devotees. Because the demons harass the devotees, therefore Krishna wants to protect his devotees, and in doing so he has to dispose of the demons as an incidental activity. Main activity is concerned with the devotees. So therefore all these three things are connected. Killing of the demons in itself is necessary. And also because it affects the establishment of Dharma, and it saves the devotees also by killing of the demons. So these are very important considerations. The first reason therefore is that Krishna kills the demons in order to keep his threefold promise. Actually, when it comes to killing of the demons, and Krishna coming to save the devotees, is a little story that comes to my mind about Akbar and Birbal. All of you, most of you have heard of Akbar and Birbal. Anyone who hasn't heard of Akbar and Birbal stories, I think most of you have heard in your childhood also perhaps. Akbar was a very well-known king, an emperor, and Birbal was a very wise minister. So one time Akbar asked Birbal, In your religion, it is seen that God incarnates, he appears on this earth to save devotees. So can't he save them sitting there wherever he is? Does he have to come all the way here to save the devotees? Is he not powerful enough to accomplish the job sitting there in his home? So then Birbal replied, I will give you the answer at the proper time. So one time what happened is that the king was going out on a boat excursion. He wanted to go on the Yamuna River for a boat ride. So naturally when a king goes, it's not just one boat. There are many boats that come. So many soldiers surrounding him, the generals and everyone for security. And his family members came as well. He only had his little boy. His son was there. And Birbal also went with his son. Now what Birbal quietly did was, he hid the real son of Akbar and he produced another boy who looked very similar to this prince. And as the king was absorbed, of course Birbal had planned all this. So the boy was sitting in another boat. And Birbal knew him. And then Akbar knew that the boy was sitting there. And Akbar and Birbal got into animated conversation. And Akbar was still thinking that it is his son who is in the other boat. Then, as per the plan, that little boy was thrown in the water. Of course, they were there to hold him. But as soon as the boy fell in the water, Akbar, without considering anything else, dived in. He swam to the boy and he rescued him. Brought him up to the surface and said, "Oh, Almighty has saved him." So after the furor had died down, then Birbal said, "My dear king, you are the emperor of the whole country, such a big kingdom you have. And you have so many generals and so many soldiers with you. But still, why did you jump in when this boy fell into the water? You know, any of your soldiers could have done it, but before they could do it, you jumped yourself. So what's the reason?" So Birbal said, "Because he's my son. Yes, there is a great bond, but still, even though he's your son, others could have done it, right? Did you as the emperor have to jump in personally to save this boy who had fallen into the water?" Then of course, as usual, Akbar was always left speechless with Birbal's replies. Then Birbal said, "Yes, now have you got my answer?" "An answer to what?" "Answer to question of why in Bhagavad Gita or in our Vedic scriptures it is described that the Lord descends personally on this planet to save his devotees. Krishna, as the Lord, is called Bhaktavatsala, one who is very affectionate to his devotees. So that is his nature. The word Vatsala comes from Vatsa. Literally, Vatsa talks, means a calf. So just as a cow is very affectionate to her calf, now what to speak of a cow being affectionate to her calf, even a lion can be very affectionate to its cow. So similarly, the Supreme Lord is very affectionate to his devotees. So it is his nature that when his devotees are in difficulty, he descends and then he saves them personally." So Akbar was very satisfied to hear this explanation. So Krishna, actually speaking, doesn't have to descend to protect the devotees. But he does so because it is his nature, out of his love. That is the nature of the relationship between the devotee and Krishna. So this is the first reason why Krishna kills the demons. That is there in the Paritramaya Sadhana verse. There is another reason, second reason. And that is explained in the 10th canto of the 33rd chapter. And this is the famous verse also. Anugrahaya bhaktanam manusham deham asthitaha bhajate tadrishi krida iha shrutva tattava bhavet. And Shukadeva Goswami says here that anugrahaya, for the sake of giving anugraha or mercy to whom? Bhaktana, to his devotees. What does Krishna do? Manusham deham asthitaha. In some places it is ashritaha. The Supreme Lord comes to a human society and appears like an ordinary human being. He comes in his original position and sometimes he comes in other forms. But here Krishna, Shukadeva Goswami is specifically referring to Krishna in Vrindavan. So he talks about manusham deham asthitaha. So out of his mercy upon the devotees, the Supreme Lord comes in his original two-armed form within the human society, appearing just like a human, which means he speaks like ordinary humans do, he eats like them, sleeps like them. And incidentally, that is the cause many times of people misjudging Krishna and thinking him to be an ordinary man because he seems to act like an ordinary man. And what does Krishna do when he comes here? within the human society, bhajate, he enjoys tadrishi krida, his different pastimes. He will steal butter, he will ras lila, and so on and so forth. Yaha shrutva, whoever hears these pastimes, tat paro bhavet, he will immediately become a loving devotee of the Lord. So in other words, the second reason for Krishna killing the demons is that he wants to give pleasure to his devotees. Because the killing of the demons entails the protection of the devotees. So the devotees feel very nice when they see a devotee being protected by the Lord. It nourishes their faith. It increases their appreciation of Krishna. And they glorify Krishna as disposing of the evil elements in the planet. In any movie, not that I'm asking you to see one, there is a hero and there is a villain. And the villain is one who does all sorts of horrible acts. And then the hero has to come along and then kill him. And even though everybody knows that eventually the hero is going to emerge victorious, but the audience is in tension, nervous, in suspense. What's going to happen now? Oh, it seems the villain is going to get the upper hand. And the story has taken a strange twist. Suddenly, the villain is now on top. What's going to happen? So in the course of that narration and viewing of that part of the cinema, the viewers are in anxiety. And then finally, when the hero kills the villain, the whole audience will get up with claps and joy. Everybody, yes, wonderful, wonderful. That's a perverted reflection. How the real happens, the devotees feel when the demons are killed. Many times the demigods who are responsible to maintain the balance in the universe, they are unable to do anything about certain powerful demons who have such powerful blessings with them that the demigods also cannot touch them. So they only have to rely on the Lord to kill these demons. And many times the demigods are afraid to come in front of the demons. So they hide behind the clouds and they're waiting and they're encouraging the Lord, "My dear Lord, please don't take so much time. Don't play with him. Just kill him right away." Because it's getting dark. And when it gets dark, the strength of the demoniac increases. So before it's sunset, please kill him. So then the Lord smiles, says, "Alright, I won't put my devotees in more anxiety." And then he kills the demon. And then the devotees, the apsaras are dancing in heaven, and the gandharvas start singing, and everybody else starts playing musical instruments. There are great celebrations that go on in the heavenly planets. So the demons are killed here. So the devotees get a lot of pleasure when they see evil demons who cause disturbance to the world and who harass and kill devotees, when these demons are killed. And not only the devotees, even ordinary people, when they hear about Krishna's protecting his devotees and killing the demons, they feel very nice. They say, "Oh, this is wonderful. Let me also worship this God. Let us see." So the second reason for Krishna's killing of the demons is that he wants to give pleasure to his devotees. So therefore we see his lifting of the Govardhan Leela, or Govardhan Hill Leela, was performed not so much for teaching a lesson to Indra, who is also his devotee by the way, but it was rather to protect his devotees, the Prajapasis, and to give them pleasure. There are many hidden purposes behind every action of Krishna. Krishna's one action accomplishes the purpose of many, many actions put together. The Prajapasis were very happy in the Govardhan Leela. Although in the beginning they were very distraught with fear and terror, because the rain was falling down in such a way as if it was the time for destruction of the universe. Have any of you seen a cloud burst? You know what is a cloud burst? Normally when rain comes, it comes in drops. Sometimes you may get a little hail and so on. or snow. But a cloud burst is just that, when a cloud bursts. Imagine if there is a 10,000 liter tank of water above and that bursts. What's going to happen? That actually happened in Kedarnath. Because the river, in fact, it exploded, there was a cloud burst and the cloud just fell apart. Imagine a cloud that holds millions and millions of liters of water. Such a miracle, isn't it? It still flows. Just see Krishna's miracles in nature. Holding millions of liters of water, instead of sending down the rain in drops, it just bursts. And those millions of liters fall all at one time. And imagine at the time of universal destruction, the rain that comes is much more than that. Within a short time, the entire earth is flooded with water. And what to speak of is flooded, you can't even see the peaks of the tallest mountains. Everything is covered over by water. So now this rainfall was the kind of rainfall that happens at that time. He called the Samvartaka clouds to do that. So the Brajavasis were terrified. And they went to Krishna because he was their only savior. And Krishna very happily lifted the Govardhan hill effortlessly with his left hand, a little finger. And when the Brajavasis came underneath Govardhan hill, initially they may have been a little careful about what if the mountain falls down on us. But when they were underneath, they experienced complete shelter, complete freedom from fear. And not only that, they experienced complete ecstasy. What was the reason for their ecstasy?
They were seeing Krishna constantly.
That's right, they were seeing Krishna constantly. But wasn't that happening on other days? Was that happening on other days?
Krishna is personally protecting them.
Yes, but on other days what used to happen?
He would go to the forest.
That's right. Every morning he would go out early morning. Krishna will rise, his friends will be outside his house. As soon as he wakes up, the first thing he does is after freshening up a bit, he goes to milk the cows. Because the cows refuse to give milk unless Krishna comes. So once he has milked the cows and set everybody in motion, then he comes back home, takes a bath, his mother Yashoda gives him bath and dresses him up and then feeds him breakfast. And his friends are eagerly waiting outside, blowing their horns. They're eager to be with Krishna for the whole day. They can't wait, they're impatient. And then early morning Krishna is up with the cows and his cowherd boyfriends in the forest. And then he comes back only at a little before sunset. So all day the Brajavasis could not see him. They could only see him within themselves, in their heart, and through the katha that they had about Krishna all day long. But physically they were not able to see. And here, under the Govardhan hill, every single Brajavasi's eyes were transfixed on Krishna for 7 days and 7 nights. Non-stop darshan. And there was no tiredness, fatigue, sleep, hunger, thirst, nothing of the sort. The Brajavasis were experiencing the highest ecstasy as they just sat there or stood there and accompanied Krishna. Therefore, Krishna for them, because Indra had acted in a demoniac way, although Indra was a demigod and a devotee, but sometimes even the devotees can act in demoniac ways. Sometimes devotees can also do horrible things. Now, although Indra is a very exalted personality, just see what he did. He tried to destroy Krishna's beloved Brajavasis. He tried to destroy Krishna's dham. Isn't that something that a demon is supposed to do? So one acharya has mentioned, I don't remember where I read this quote. He said that the fact that asuras exist is good, is necessary. So why? Because if the asuras didn't exist, the devotees may have become asuras. The demigods might have become asuras. Because the demons are there and they are constantly threatening the demigods are always on their toes and always depending on Krishna. But if there is no one to stop the demigods or the devotees, then the devotees may get puffed up. Even if they don't do horrible activities like this, they may get puffed up. And that is precisely one of the reasons why Krishna caused the Yadu dynasty to kill themselves. Because there was no one who could stop them. They were so enormously powerful. Only they themselves could deal with each other. So for us, we may sometimes say the demons are giving us so much trouble, the non-devotees, but it's good for us. We need something like that to keep us in our own place so that we don't deviate from devotional service. So Indra, even though he was a great devotee, and we should not criticize him, we can understand this to be part of Krishna's pastimes, but we learn a lesson. The lesson that the activity was demonic. And Krishna protected his Vrajavasis and gave them immense pleasure by performing this pastime, uplifting the Govardhan Hill. So anyway, this is the second reason for Lord Krishna's killing of asuras, to give pleasure to the devotees and to attract their minds to him and to increase their love for him by hearing about these pastimes. Therefore, the hearing process is so important for us as devotees. The more we hear about Krishna's pastimes, the more our love for Krishna will increase. Even if those pastimes pertain to his killing of the demons or the Srishti Lila and so on. Now, reason number 3. Not only does Krishna kill the demons to give pleasure to his devotees, he also kills the demons to give pleasure to himself. And I said, what? How can Krishna get pleasure by killing the demons? You see, the tendency to fight and the tendency to get angry and so on is there in all of us, isn't it? Why is it there in all of us? Because it's in Krishna. Only thing is we should learn to dovetail it properly so that we don't use it in a way that is harmful to the world and to ourselves. So the killing of demons is an act that Krishna does to enjoy a certain taste. It's called a veer rasa. Krishna is after all Rasika Shekhar. He is Rasaraj. He relishes all kinds of tastes and mellows. Transcendental mellows. Now we know that there are two kinds of rasas. What are the two kinds of rasas?
Primary
and second. What are the five primary rasas?
Shanta,
Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, Madhurya. So these rasas we are all very familiar with. Now apart from that, there are also secondary rasas. Secondary rasas or mellows are those that embellish the main rasas. They ornament the main rasas. And they make the main rasa more relishable. They increase the happiness or the ecstasy that is felt by Krishna as well as the devotees. So how many such secondary rasas do we have?
Seven.
Anyone remember them? Bhayanaka. Bhayanaka means? Ghastliness. Okay, that's one. Second?
Wonder.
Adbhuta. Wonder, have a sense of wonder. Okay? Veenras, yes. The rasa of chivalry. Hasya, which is laughter. Rodra, which is?
Anger.
No, rasas, we are talking rasas, seven rasas.
Hasya
is the Karuna. Karuna is compassion. And then there is, of course, Bhaya is fear. Bhayanaka, Bhaya is fear. So there are these seven rasas. These seven rasas can come and go and, as I said, increase the taste of the main rasa. So Virasa is one very important rasa which Krishna likes to enjoy. And sometimes Prabhupada says kings used to keep wrestlers in their employ. And these wrestlers would fight with the king to give the king some wrestling practice. And the king would like to engage his strength. One time there was a devotee who was very quarrelsome. So devotees were a little upset with him and they approached Prabhupada and said, "What do we do for this devotee? He's quarreling with everybody." So he's very argumentative and keeps quarreling. So Prabhupada said, "Send him to Rishikesh and Haridwar and let him quarrel with the Mayavadis." Why should he fight with the devotees? Fight with so many other people to quarrel with, go and send him there. So even these quarrelsome tendencies and fighting nature can be engaged in Krishna's service. So anyway, Krishna also wants to enjoy this. And the fighting spirit in the Lord is there, so he's looking for a suitable partner to who can fight with him. It has to be someone who is very special. Now the question is, if he has to fight with an opponent who is a demon, there is one problem in the spiritual world. What is that problem?
There's
no demons there. So who does Krishna fight with? So he can't experience his virasa because nobody is there to fight. So then he says, "Okay, I'll go down to the material world and there I'll fight with them. There are demons. So I can engage my virasa, my tendency to fight, and I can get enjoyment by fighting, having a good fight. So I have to go to the material world." But even in the material world, can any ordinary person be a suitable opponent for Krishna? It has to be some real powerful demon. It can't be an ordinary demon of this world. It has to be someone especially powerful. So sometimes Krishna has to send his associates from there to become demons over here, just so that Krishna can fight. And sometimes he may empower the demons here also. So the demons, they get empowered by Krishna, and then they fight with Krishna, and Krishna gets a lot of pleasure in fighting. So now, this point about Krishna killing the demons because he experiences pleasure is a very important point for us, because it makes us understand that this material world also has other purposes than what we think it has. Why was the material world formed? What is the basic thing we hear when we first become devotees? Why does the material world exist? Yeah, because the jivas who are here are those who are rebellious jivas who want to enjoy separate from Krishna. So we have been hearing it from day one in Krishna consciousness, correct? So those rebellious souls are sent over here. It's like a Disneyland, fantasy land, where you go to enact your fantasies, and then you are in a material body trying to imagine I'm controller, I'm enjoyer, I'm the proprietor. So therefore this material world has been created to facilitate the vain fulfillment of the false desires for enjoyment of the living entities, conditioned living entities, rebellious ones, and also as a place of rectification for them, just like a prison is. So we have been hearing this from the beginning. But what we don't sometimes realize is that the material world also serves some other important purposes. This for the jivas, yes. But it also serves as a platform for Krishna to perform certain pastimes which he does not do in the spiritual world. Can you imagine? So how important is the material world? Because Krishna can do certain things here which he doesn't do over there. So the material world has an important place in the performance of Krishna's pastimes. And therefore there are some devotees who eternally accompany Krishna in the material world. In one quote, Srila Prabhupada says in one letter, that Arjuna is eternally in the material world with Krishna. What did I say?
Eternally
in the material world. I didn't make a mistake. Prabhupada says Arjuna is eternally in the material world with Krishna. How is that? The material world is destroyed, isn't it? Every now and then. So how is it that Arjuna is eternally with Krishna in the material world? Because everywhere in the material world, Krishna goes from planet to planet or universe to universe performing pastimes. The sum total of all the universe constitutes the material world. So at any given time, there is a pastime of every single pastime of Krishna is going on somewhere. So Krishna is subduing Kali in one universe. Krishna is killing Putana in another universe. Krishna is, let's say, killing Keshi in another universe. Krishna is narrating Bhagavad Gita in another universe. So all these pastimes of Krishna are going on everywhere. After it is performed in one universe, the same pastime is begun by Krishna in another universe. Where in the first universe, the next Leela starts. And that universe, and the second Leela goes to that universe, it is performed there. And here the third Leela starts. This is happening all over the material world. So Arjuna is there everywhere, accompanying Krishna. Because the material world, as I mentioned, is a place where Krishna also performs many activities. Krishna has been born. Does it happen in the spiritual world? No. What is Krishna? What does Krishna look like in the in Goloka Vrindavan? At what age? What is his age? He is Kaishor. Kaishor is the age where he is pre-youth, adolescent. Teens. He is early to mid-teens. That is how Krishna appears. He appears like a fresh youth of 15 to 16 years of age. Nava Yauvanam. Kishore. And Srimati Radharani appears a little younger. So she is Kishori. And Krishna is eternally at that age. So Krishna's age never is in Goloka Vrindavan is never below or above that. Whereas when he appears in the material world, what happens? He is born. He goes through babyhood. He has so many pastimes which he does here. And then he grows up slightly. He drinks milk and he steals butter. He does so many things. And then eventually he reaches the age of Kaishore. And then after that in the material world, he stops always. Krishna explains this, Srila Prabhupada explains this in his purports in the Bhagavad Gita, fourth chapter. So Krishna stops growing once he has attained the Kaishora age. Why? Because that is his eternal age in Goloka Vrindavan. He never grows beyond that. Although actually he is the oldest. But nevertheless, he does his spiritual body never grows beyond that. So similarly, we can understand that the material world provides a facility to add variety and spice to the Lord's pastimes. To facilitate the Lord performing pastimes which he doesn't do in the spiritual world. Now, in Brihad Bhagavat Amrita of Sanatana Goswami, he says that although there are no demons in Goloka Vrindavan, but sometimes to nourish that rasa a little bit, there are rumors floating. Oh, some demons are coming, demons are coming. Oh, demons are coming, where is Krishna, where is Krishna, where are the demons? There's just a little scare, a little rumor sometimes around cinema. But actually demons don't. So in this connection, I want to mention what Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has said about Krishna's pastimes. He says that Krishna's pastimes are of two kinds. One is called Nitya Leela, the other is called Naimittika Leela. Nitya Leela are those pastimes that go on eternally in the spiritual world. What are the pastimes going on eternally in the spiritual world? Can you give some examples?
Is the Rasa Leela?
Rasa Leela.
Playing with his devotee.
Playing with the devotee, cowherd boys.
Raising the cows.
Raising the cows in the forest. Every day Krishna goes out to graze cows. Yes, so these are some examples of Nitya Leela. Naimittika Leela, on the other hand, are those They happen only occasionally. They happen for some purpose at a certain place in a certain circumstance. Like
killing of
the demons. So in the material world, when Krishna descends, Vrindavan also descends with him. So the Vrindavan that is in the spiritual world is called Paravyoma Vrindavan. The spiritual Vrindavan. Goloka Vrindavan. And that same Vrindavan also manifests here in the material world. And that type it is called Bhauma Vrindavan. Bhauma because it is on Bhumi or earth. So what is the difference between the pastimes of Krishna that happen in Paravyoma Vrindavan, Goloka Vrindavan on one hand and on Bhauma Vrindavan on the other hand? That's right, perfect. In Goloka Vrindavan, there is Nitya Leela going on. Whereas in the Bhauma Vrindavan, there is a mix of the Nitya and the Naimittika Leelas. Both kinds of pastimes are combined here. So this way Krishna is performing these pastimes of killing the demons here because he doesn't do them in the spiritual world. Now I'll ask you a question. Everything about Krishna is complete, isn't it? You agree? The spiritual world is also complete. So how can there be some deficiency in the spiritual world because of which Krishna has to come to the material world? So does it mean that the spiritual world is deficient in some way?
No, because
material is part of the spiritual world. But even not prakat enough, either way, but how come Krishna has to come here?
This is also part of.
Because this is also spiritual. The material world is not existing outside of Krishna. The material world is also a part of the spiritual world. Inasmuch as a jail is a part of the city, but is a part of the kingdom. Ultimately, the Lord is the king of that kingdom. So the material world is a small cloud in the spiritual sky. It is not that the material world is outside Krishna's jurisdiction. Because it is a part of the spiritual world, it is a part where laws, certain different types of laws apply. Just as in the prison, which is a part of the kingdom, certain other types of laws apply. But nevertheless, the same king is in charge. And matter and spirit, for Krishna, what difference does it make? Matter and spirit are from our perspective. So when for Krishna, everything is spirit. So therefore, in the material world, you cannot say that it is outside of Krishna's jurisdiction. So the spiritual world is complete because it includes the material world. So the existence of the material world also goes to make the spiritual world more complete. Is this point clear? Yes? So the material world is not such a bad place as we always say. As a rogue, yes? So, there is no difference between the Vrindavan here and the Vrindavan there. And Krishna wanted to show the Vrindavasis that. And therefore, he actually showed them Goloka Vrindavan. And then they realized, oh, there is no difference between that and this. So, Krishna wants to teach us that if you are in Krishna consciousness, there is no difference between being in Tobacco, being in Vrindavan and being in Goloka Vrindavan. Because it's all a matter of consciousness. So if one is absorbed in Krishna consciousness here, one is in Vrindavan. So spirit, matter, the whole distinction then just goes away. So these are some interesting points. So this was reason number 3. Now reason number 4, 5 and 6 we will talk about tomorrow. And we will continue. But let's recapitulate what were the 3 reasons. Because I'll be singing a song now, so we need some time for that. So what are the 3 reasons that we talked about? First reason is? Say that again.
Protection of devotees.
For keeping his promise. The first reason is Krishna kills the demons because he keeps his promise. And in that reason, there are 3 sub-reasons. As given in the verse, Paritranaya Sadhana. Second reason?
Eliminating the demons.
No, to give pleasure to his devotees and to attract their hearts to him and increase their love for him. That's the second reason for his killing demons. Third reason? To give pleasure to himself so that he can enjoy the Virasa nicely. To do things that he can't do in the spiritual world. And there are other reasons, and we'll come to that tomorrow. So what we will do is, we will sing a song. It is not directly connected to this, but I thought because the song is so nice, very simple song. And it's called Govinda Damodara Stotram. How many of you have heard this? Yes, anyone else? Two. Now it has 70 verses. We can maybe put it on there. Okay. It has about 70 verses. Now don't get scared. We're not going to chant all 70 now. We'll divide these over the next sessions. So at the end of every lecture, I'll sing about 15 to 20 of these verses. That will take up 10 or 12 minutes. And I've got some pictures here also.
Can you turn up the light?
This Govinda Damodara Stotram was composed by, anybody knows?
Bilva Mangal Thakur.
Bilva Mangal Thakur is, of course, the legendary, celebrated, great devotee of Krishna. What is his most famous work known as? His most famous book?
Krishna Karnamrita.
Yes. So he has written this. Actually, there is a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the 10th canto which forms the basis for this. We'll come to that as well. But we'll go into this song and chant the first 15 or 16 of the verses now. So, are you ready? Okay, till we have it up on the screen, if you have any questions, you can ask. Yes.
The question is, like, Maharaj, you told Krishna, every moment he is busy in his pastimes. In some universe, he may be delivering probably the message to Arjuna. So my question is, the content of Bhagavad Gita, like the slokas, are the same slokas or like...
Okay, the question is that when Krishna speaks Bhagavad Gita in different universes at different times, are the shlokas exactly the same? Not necessarily. They may be vastly different also. Essential knowledge is the same. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says in the 4th chapter that Imam Vivaspati Yogam Protavanaham Abhyade. I had first spoken this Bhagavad Gita message to the Sun God Vivaswan. But it's not necessary that he spoke 700 verses there. He could have spoken much more. And the circumstances and context in which the Bhagavad Gita there was spoken may have been completely different. Here it was a battlefield setting. So the whole first chapter talks about so many other things. The surveying of the two armies and this, so many other topics are covered. So the essential knowledge is the same. But the manner of presentation and the format, well,
my related question, these four yugas, are they specific to one universe or in different universes, like for example in our this universe it is Kali Yuga, in some universe it may be Dwapara Yuga currently?
Could be, but you see, we are talking of time spans that are so huge, the lifetime of the universe, that it really doesn't matter because universes are all of different sizes. Our universe is of a medium size. There are other universes that are very huge, millions and millions of times the size of our universe. So it could be because they're all at different distances from Mahavishnu as they expand. And as they come back again, the time scales may be different somewhere. So, okay, we start.